Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Mark.
Today is July 19, 2015, for the benefit of the people who are hearing the recording. My name is Mark Perez. We're talking about sort of jobs that we have in the church. My job is to make sure that when Hugh Ross is not here, somebody suitable is here to replace him. So today, I counted myself suitable, and you get to determine whether that really matters. Last week, or the week before last, we had a very interesting discussion in this class. It was about the same-sex marriage question and the same-sex marriage law that got, I guess you want to say, judicially legislated. I mean, it's kind of a funny way of putting it, but it was created by the Supreme Court. And after that happened, after we had that discussion, Ross and I had also spoken in another class, a couple of sessions, and one of the things that arose in my mind was that it's been a while since the folks in this class have had a talk about worldviews. Because it was pretty obvious that in some cases, when we were discussing this, some folks were losing touch with the idea that the United States of America is not a Christian country anymore. Or if it is, it's not the kind of Christian country that most of us believed it was. Then I was talking to some other people and asking them, what is it that you think the folks who come up to these kind of decisions, what are they thinking? What goes through their mind? Is it just some particular opportunity for power, or is it something else? And what I realized when I was talking to these different people, that they were fundamentally missing the point of worldviews. That the people who are making these decisions, and making all sorts of decisions, have a different worldview from us. And yet we don't even know what a worldview really is in many respects. Or how to identify its features. Or how to ask some questions about worldviews that are different. Or are even sensible. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And this is an update of a talk I did a couple of years ago, 3 years ago actually, almost to the day, in this class, with some more stuff in it, but I'm sure that there's probably about 1 times 10 to the minus 43 chance that we'll get through it all today. But it's divided into 2 sections, so if we don't get it done today, we'll get it done another day. So let's start. Up on the screen, you see an image. And we've had a chance to look at that image because it's been on all morning. When you see this image, what do you see? Just anybody give me an idea. What is it, when you look at this image, what do you think it depicts?
Somebody praying.
Somebody praying. Okay, so there's a woman, her hands clasped underneath her chin. She's looking up. There's candles before her, candles subdued in the background. And given that kind of look there, it kind of looks like a church. So when we see this, we in this room, most of us, coming from a worldview that's Christian, we see somebody who's praying. Is it possible somebody else looking at this would see something other than somebody praying? Yes. So we're going to look at a few worldviews just to show the contrast between them and ours, and then we're going to go into some other stuff. So first of all, let's look at some worldviews and see how they compare with ours. So here is what we see. We see somebody praying. Look at this poster. So on this poster, you have signs or symbols of different religious groups. You have Christianity, Islam, Judaism. I don't know what the one on the right is, if somebody else knows. Universalism or something. And it says, adults with imaginary friends are stupid. What worldview would you think that comes from?
Secular.
A secular worldview? Okay, that's a real worldview. What else? Say it again.
Atheist.
atheist. Yes, please.
Naturalism and materialism.
Naturalistic, materialistic, atheistic.
Intolerant.
Yeah, well, definitely intolerant because it's not tolerant of anything.
Communistic?
Well, certainly communism is a worldview, or is at least contained in a worldview. So, here we have...
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing today? Did you have your hand up?
Yes.
No wonder you raised your hand. Okay. Say that loudly. Okay, so are you thinking this is a Hinduistic poster?
Not necessarily, but they have visual gods like that.
Oh, I get what you're saying. Okay, thank you. So, let's start over again here. The first image we interpreted as prayer. We look at it through the lenses of the people who did this poster, and we have something completely different. They see it as a stupid person who has an imaginary friend. Now think about that for a second. Who are the people to whom we are to minister?
We are to minister.
These people here. The people who think that adults with imaginary friends are stupid, and that people who are praying have what? Imaginary friends, yes. And so if we have imaginary friends, what do they think of us? We're stupid. Yeah, it took a little while for you to figure that out. Think about that for a second, ponder it, and let's look at something else here that'll give you an impression about where we're going next.
Okay.
Steve, I know you can't, but I'm going to describe them to you.
Okay.
So on the screen right now is a blue image. It looks like the Scientology, not quite.
Avatar.
It looks like a photo negative in blue hue in the center, and it's a face, the upper half of a face with the top of it somewhat exploded, and ominously in the center of it is what? It looks like a what?
Board.
Well, the center. Yeah, a mushroom cloud. Explosion, the power. And then on the sides, what do you have?
My work.
Printed circuit board. Yeah, a printed circuit board. And so what this image conveys, if we're to believe the person who actually put it together, is two facets of humanity. That humanity is immensely powerful, capable of technology, creative, and extremely energetic. Now look at this poster and tell me what you think the worldview is of this one. We have the same international prohibition signs across Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. It says morality is doing what is right, regardless of what you're told. Religion is doing what you're told, regardless of what is right. Think about that for a minute and come up with an ideology, a worldview, some description that you would apply to this. Now think for a second about the poster that was before that. The artwork that was before that was describing the power of the human mind and all that it can do and its energy. What can the human do? Can you think of an ism that might be represented by this? That morality is doing what is right regardless of what you are told.
Humanism.
I think that's probably right on the money. Because what does humanism hold above all else?
Right.
Say that again?
That humans know what is naturally right or wrong.
Yes, that in particular, that humans are their own right and wrong. Yes. So that there is no reason to appeal to a God. Humans can create their own morality without a God. So this is humanism. And it references that image before that, which was an image of humanism, that we're in control of the universe. We have all the power and energy through our minds. Now, this is a little bit of abstraction. I wanted to toy with your artistic aesthetic here for a little while. If I were to ask you what this is, you could probably give me a bunch of different descriptions, but I'll tell you what the artist thinks it is. On the screen are a bunch of white rectangular figures that are supposed to look like bed frames. Now, they're on the ceiling. They're suspended from the ceiling. And on the floor, there's a bunch of lights that are supposed to be where? In the ceiling, but they're on the floor.
So you put the slide in upside down.
I put the slide in upside down, obviously. Except for one problem. That it's pretty obvious that this is some kind of museum setting, and so the ceiling really is on top, and the floor really is on the bottom, but everything else is mixed up. So what the artist is trying to convey here is actually a worldview. And it includes, or a part of a worldview, and it includes the notion that what should be on one thing isn't, and what should be something else isn't. And that putting them both together is just confusion. You can't really know which way is up. By looking at the image, you don't really know what way is up, or do you? So let's look at another poster and tell me what you think the worldview is that, after looking at this, might suggest. And this one I'm going to have to read aloud because I'm not sure everybody's going to see it. So on this black and white poster, there are two definitions, atheism and Christianity. So I'll do Christianity first. Christianity is the belief that some cosmic Jewish zombie can make you live forever if you symbolically eat his flesh and telepathically tell him that you accept him as your master. So he can remove an evil force from your soul that is present in humanity because a rib woman was convinced by a talking snake to eat from a magical tree. It's pretty poetic, isn't it? Very poetic. So I did not write that.
I have another word.
We're not done yet, Warren. We'll get to it. But let's look at what the person says about atheism. The belief that there was nothing, and nothing happened to nothing, and then nothing magically expanded for no reason, creating everything, and then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason whatsoever until self-replicating bits, which then turned into dinosaurs. And then at the bottom it says, I don't know the truth, and neither do you. Warren, do you still have a comment pending?
Well, they're both cynical.
Very good.
What's cynicism?
Cynicism. So Warren says they're both cynical. You say it's cynicism. If we're going to make an ideology out of it, then it would be cynicism. Yeah.
The ideology of Dadaism.
Tell me about what Dadaism is.
Dadaism at first was just an art form.
Okay.
But then it started translating into cultural coding that nothing has any meaning at all because it can be called one thing and then the other thing the next moment.
Oh, I thought that was postmodernism. But if that's Dadaism, then I guess that's good. Thank you for that definition. I appreciate that.
Doesn't this contradict humanism, which said we know everything?
Yes, it does. Does this conflict with atheism?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, pretty straight up. It's saying that atheists believe that nothing, that there was nothing, nothing happened to nothing, nothing magically exploded for no reason, creates everything and a bunch of everything magically rearrange itself for no apparent reason, and then creates self-replicating bits that turn into dinosaurs. I mean, it's pretty funny. I mean, both of these are really funny. And they are cynical. They are cynical. But there's also another worldview or another ism. Cynicism absolutely is inherent in this. Both of these are cynical statements because neither one of them really represents what the people said. They don't represent the position of atheists. This is not what atheists really think. This is not what Christians really think. So what other ism could you apply to this?
Agnosticism.
Thank you. What do you? How would you define agnosticism, Jamie?
You can't know the truth.
You can't know. You cannot know. Thank you. Some people believe that agnosticism means I just don't know. That I'm agnostic because I really don't know whether God exists or whether God does not exist. That is not what agnosticism is. Agnosticism really is that you cannot know whether there is a God. So we've had atheism. We've looked at that. What atheists think about our notions of Christianity. And we've had what else? We had atheism. The H-ism. Which one was that?
Humanism.
That humanity, that mankind makes up its own mind about morality and among other things, but morality especially. Then we have this, which is cynicism, or if you want to call it a little bit broader term, agnosticism, that you cannot know the truth. You cannot know the truth. Please.
I didn't know that it was I cannot know the truth. I thought it was I didn't know like that. But isn't that kind of cannot, isn't that kind of David Hume in a way?
Kind of like David Hume? Yes.
Because he said you can't really know, you have to kind of have the faith, which is what, I don't know.
Yeah, David Hume.
Yeah,
unless you could prove it, but he was denying that you could prove it, because to prove it would be to violate the laws of nature, and by definition you can't violate the laws of nature because they're law-like, they're inviolable, which was his prescription for trying to eliminate, what, miracles. Please.
It also harks back to Pontius Pilate.
In what respect?
What is truth?
What is truth with a capital T, right? Yes. It does harken back there. Please, in the back.
Right. I think it was Aldous Huxley who coined the word agnosticism in the late 1800s, coming out of the free thinker movement, which still exists. He did it, I think, fairly because he was trying to choose through the debate of evolution whether God really existed and how he intervened. And he says, I'm going to be fair, I don't know. But I like him a little bit more than other agnostics who use it as an excuse to not know and operate in the canon.
Yes, yes, that is a little bit fairer. A little bit fairer. All right, so here we are, three different worldviews. At least we could say they're parts of three different worldviews. The worldview, as we'll see, is a lot more comprehensive than any one ideology. Let's look at one more. Now, I did not put this together. I want to make sure the credit is here at the whatistheevidence.org. This is their poster. This is pretty simple. Which ideology or which worldview does this suggest?
Universalism?
No, there's actually a little bit more than that, because universalism comprehends not just Christianity, but all religions. Is it Christian? Yeah, let me help the people who cannot see this. You have the C of the word. It says science and Christianity coexist in me. And the C is what? A magnet, a horseshoe magnet. The O is the crown of thorns. The E has a little inset of E equals MC2 in it. The X with the umlaut over it, I do not know what that symbol is. I know it's a mathematical symbol, but I don't know what it's a function of. I don't know. The I is what? The I is a DNA molecule with a globe atop of it. And then the S is another stylized mathematical figure, and the T, of course, is the Christian cross. So this... If we were to say this reflects a worldview, could we legitimately say that this is a Christian worldview? But a very particular kind of Christian, wouldn't you say? What kind of Christian would see this as opposed to another kind of Christian? I won't go smart and dumb or anything like that, but we talk a lot in here about creationists who are young earth and creationists who are old earth, and many of the young earth creationists don't hold a high view of science or of scientists. And so this is not only a Christian worldview reflected here, because it talks about science and Christianity coexisting in me. It's a very particular version. Please.
It implies that science and Christianity are wholly different and do not agree, but can we just accept them both and get along? That's all, I mean, there's no reason to make that statement, because what are we here for with you? He explains that science and the Bible are converging.
Yes.
Every time we meet, we learn something new, right? We get
yes.
a little bit closer. That implies the opposite, divergence.
I didn't see it that way. Thank you. I don't get that out of it, but that's when I look at that and I think of what you're saying, there are some ways of looking at it the way exactly the way you're describing it. Because if you look at some of the coexist signs, what do they represent? Positions that are hostile to each other.
That's universalism.
That is universalism. But I see your point, and I think there may be an actually really legitimate interpretation of that. Thank you. So we've looked at now four different perspectives, four different ideologies, four different worldviews that are expressed within these ideologies or contain these ideologies. So now we have to ask the question, what is a worldview? What is it, some fantasy? Is it something that we just imagine, or is it something much more tangible? So I'm going to pose it to you. We have a little bit of time before we have to leave to talk about this, about what a worldview is. And so I'm going to give you a definition. But before I do, I want to tell you that if you look up worldview in Wikipedia or the internet, or you go through your philosophy books, which is what I did, you're going to find a lot of definitions of worldview. Part of the reason that there are so many of these definitions is that it's so hard to pin down. It is like trying to ask, what is the definition of science? Just when you think you've got it, somebody else comes along and says, oh, I have a counterexample that shows that this isn't entirely the definition of science. Or I have a counterexample that this isn't entirely what a worldview is. It comprehends something else as well. So that is what we're stuck against when we're trying to interpret or trying to define a worldview. But we've got to try, because it does exist. And we have some elements of worldviews that I'm going to go through. So let me open it up to the group right now. You right now are going to wear the hat of the metaphysician or the philosopher. And so you get to come up with your own definition of worldview, of what you think a worldview is. Help me. Mara.
Oh, how somebody sees the world, how they see how, you know, where we came from, where we're going, what's your purpose, and how they kind of rule their life that way and go through life.
Thank you. Thank you. I have one over here, and then I'm going to go back left again. Yes, please. You don't think you can come to a worldview? Okay, so you believe that there is no such thing as a worldview, or that it is impossible to know what it is, which I'm trying to figure out where you're going. Yes. All right.
I think it's a worldview right now.
Then let's that's an interesting proposition. And your proposition, if I understand you properly, is that there is no one comprehensive worldview yet. Is that what you're saying?
Yet.
Okay. Great. So Mara has a definition. You have one that questions whether you really can have a worldview. Let me go to Ross.
I would say it is the assumptions that a person has that determine how they interpret what they experience in the world.
So the assumptions that somebody has that affects how they interpret?
Affect and will determine how they interpret what they experience.
Thank you. go to the right side. Yes, ma'am.
As I understand it, and I'm going to try to not trip up on my words on this, because I keep thinking it, and I'm going to see if I can translate.
You can think out loud and trip up all you want. Please do.
As far as I know it, worldview is an individual constantly in development, changing label for how we have and continue to understand our place in the world around us, as far as what our future destiny is supposed to be, what our future, what our past actions have meant to the world around us, and what the actions of others around us should mean to us.
Nicely done. I don't think you tripped over your words at all. I think you did it very nicely. Thank you. Have you read Hegel?
No.
No?
I should probably.
Well, I don't know about that. But, but what you, the way you described that was what we would call neo-Hegelian. It kind of comprehends everything all in one big bucket. So it was very well done. My compliments to the chef. Cheers. Warren, please.
My definition of what I think of a worldview is close to a lot of these definitions, but closest probably to Ross's. It's an attempt to explain what we see. And because it's the belief that what we see isn't the entire picture.
Thank you.
And they're opposing worldviews. I mean, there's just not one view. I mean, as you pointed out, there's many.
Well, we saw at least four ideologies, all of which conflict with each other. They're not completely consonant. They're not even close to being consonant. Some of them are really antipodal. They're in conflict with each other in the extreme. Let me, sir.
Well, I think kind of playing off of Ross's thoughts and thoughts too. It's a perspective. You know, your worldview defines what you see the world around you as being and why it is, and then it also defines who you see yourself as in relation to that view and how you choose your behavior or your interpretation of what you see in terms of how you choose to make choices.
Thank you. You're getting into something that the lady on the edge over there talked about too, and it's reflective. It's how do I view myself, or what am I in this big system, in addition to a lot of other things. Thank you. John?
I was just thinking it could be expressed as the perspective on the ultimate nature of reality.
The what on the ultimate nature of reality?
Perspective.
The perspective on...
Or even an opinion, but perspective might be a little more general.
Thank you. Perspective on the ultimate nature of reality. Thank you.
I was thinking of Ken Sample's illustration of a pair of spectacles that you put on. You can put on, I wear glasses, and they help me to see the world clearly. And a proper worldview will help us to see the world clearly. A bad worldview will distort things around us.
Yes.
So I think the Christian worldview, in my opinion, helps us to see reality clearly, whereas an atheistic worldview or whatever would distort things.
Thank you. A pair of spectacles through which you view the world, and the spectacles affect what you see. How does the world look? What does it mean to me? Very much so. If you look up worldview on the internet and you look up all the definitions, if you just click on the thing that says images, you'll see a lot of images with glasses. The one that I thought was the greatest one was a lady sitting in a chair at an optometrist office with that thing that, okay, would you like to see number one or number two? And number three better than number one. Because that's pretty much what worldviews are. They're clickable. I click this, I'm an atheist. I click this one, oh, I've got an atheist on this side and a Christian on that side. What does that turn me into? Psychotic, really. But you get where I'm going with that. Is that those, whatever lenses you have in there, once the two are together, if you have binocular vision, and something's in focus, what are those lenses focusing on? What are the lenses focusing on? So Ken Sample's description of a worldview, or his metaphor, if you will, as being a set of lenses through which we get to see what the world is really deep. I'll go one more. Does anybody else want to try this, please?
The four examples that you gave all have to do with what the philosophers would call epistemology. And it occurs to me that maybe I could make that contemporary by stealing a phrase from Watergate. All these worldviews are answers to the question, what can I know and how can I know it?
What can I know? All those worldviews are answers to the question, what can I know and how can I know it? The epistemological question, and what does it mean to know? Thank you very much. That moves us into where we're going to go next, because we only have a half an hour, and I want Dave to tackle me while I'm up front here, because I'm going overtime. I love you, Dave. I know you wouldn't tackle me or do a Bruce Lee flying kick or something, but here's where we're going next. I'm going to give you one definition that comes from a philosopher, and it's just as good or just as incomplete as any other. But we're going to start from this one to give us a vantage point. And here's what Ken Funk said from Oregon State University. He said, a worldview is a set of beliefs, which is a starting point, about fundamental aspects of reality that ground and influence all one's perceiving and thinking and knowing and doing. Now, if you remember what people in this class were saying, this is very similar to what everybody in the class was saying. We had different ways of saying it, and there were some that were more complete than others. But this is where we're going when we're talking about a worldview. This is what we're going to be using as our operating definition for the next 30 minutes or so. I'll leave it up there because I see some people actually writing. So let me say it aloud again for the people who are listening to this on the recording. A worldview is a set of beliefs, the set of beliefs, about fundamental aspects of reality that ground and influence all one's perceiving, thinking, knowing, and doing. It's what you do. So, is there a set of things that are the causes of a worldview? Are there things that actually create worldviews? What do you think? Notwithstanding that there's something up here that's already telling you. Do you think there are causes of worldviews? Are worldviews created, or are they just spontaneous? You just are born with one. You come factory equipped with a worldview. They're created. Now, we as Christians need to remember this, that worldviews are created. They're not created by God, they're created by people and cultures. All right, so how are they created? What causes? What are the things that form a person's worldview? I've put, 2, 4, 6, 8 things up there? 7? Okay. I should have put numbers on, that would have been easier. How many more can you think of? Social media. Is there a profound effect on people's worldview from social media? Hugely, yes. It's very, very influential. What else?
Movies.
Helen. Say it again, Helen.
Political.
Politics. Okay, now that's, if you have that, you're going to be one or the other. But do politics themselves influence a worldview? Sure. Warren?
Movies and media.
Movies. Do movies affect our worldviews? Yeah, they do. Ted, did you have something?
Yeah, direct spiritual intervention by God or Satan.
Yes. Yeah, that has a big effect. I would think if Satan talked to you or God talked to you, it would probably affect your worldview. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure if that counts under emotionally evocative events or culture, but traveling. Because not just worldview, like how we understand moral things, like why we do certain things,
yes.
How we understand others might change if we, say, go to
Yes. So you're describing travel and then the experience of somebody else's culture or operating ways of doing business.
Geographic.
Geographics?
I was going to say geographic, but you know, where you're at on the earth also influences your worldview.
Sure. How does language affect it? Yeah, first of all, if you can't communicate with somebody else, it's very difficult to know what their worldview really is, because there's a certain amount of cognitive content to a worldview that's excluded from your understanding of the other person because you cannot talk to them. But does language itself, does having a particular language affect your worldview? Please, in the back. Bomb shelter, gun.
Things like that.
Yes.
And it wasn't until like about 2 or 3 weeks in that we learned knife, fork. it works both ways. Your experience forms the importance that you put on certain words, but if you're a person coming from outside of that culture, those things can have an effect.
So as you learned Hebrew and you went to Israel, the first words that you learned were bomb shelter, guns, and things that were a threat to you or would be safety. And then you learned the more quotidian things like forks and spoons and things like that, right? Okay. So is there another way that you can think of that language can inform or create a worldview? More.
Words and phrases in a particular language have a certain connotation, a certain bend to them that's different from the words and the phrases in another language.
Yes. That's where we were really going. What Warren is saying is that some languages have particular phrasing and connotations that are absent in other languages. Some languages you just cannot translate word for word exactly the same way, even in the same sense, to certain other languages. So in that respect, does the language itself restrict the worldview? It could. It could. It certainly will influence it. If you think, for example, we've had one of our missionaries who's in Africa who described how he was trying to help translate the Bible. He's trying to translate the Bible, a particular Bible passage that talks about Jesus taking a boat out onto the sea. Well, he's talking to a group of people in Africa who have never seen a sea and don't know what a boat is. So your worldview approaching them is completely different. They don't know what snow is. They don't know what a whole bunch of things is. There's even one culture whose language doesn't have numbers. In South America. So, all of these factors here, I think this one here, the emotionally evocative events, as I've studied worldviews, is probably the most profound. Because when you're stricken with emotion, it sticks with you far more potently than most cognitive arguments do. Most people are swayed by emotion first and cognition last. Although some people, that's flipped. We need to think about that, because when we look at somebody or talking with somebody who has a different worldview from us, did they acquire that worldview from emotionally evocative events? And if they did, how do we approach that worldview? Will we have to acknowledge and then understand the emotions of those events? Yes, please.
Especially for really sensitive things, like a lot of people might have been raised in a Christian or a Catholic family, but after possibly losing a loved one and being told they're in a better place and that they're free, that they're feeling better now, that they feel abandoned, that they feel betrayed because now that they're separate from their family, that they finally feel better. So it can be a really, really sensitive topic.
Yes, thank you. What is one of the top reasons people reject Christianity?
How would a good God allow
yes.
that to happen?
Exactly. The problem of evil. How can you believe in a God who allows little children to be tortured to death? How can you believe in a God who creates tornadoes and wipes out populations? How can you believe in a God that does earthquakes? You just keep on filling in the blanks. How can you believe in a God that does this and that? Are those emotionally evocative events? Yes, they are. And they stop some people from believing in Christianity or from accepting Christ, is a better way to put it. Because this is all about accepting Christ, not accepting a particular entity or ideology. It's about having a relationship with a person, the God of the universe. What are the elements of a worldview? You have 20 minutes to go through the elements of a worldview. What are your guesses on whether we'll make it?
1 × 10⁻⁴.
There you are. I'm with you. However, we're going to start with the one philosophical term that was already brought up in class, epistemology. These are color-coded for a reason, because they're clustered. Epistemology and metaphysics are two ways of looking at the world, cosmology and teleology, about the grand things, purpose, and so forth. Theology and anthropology. Axiology, do you know what axiology is? Good, then we'll learn. So let's start with epistemology. And by the way, when we talk about elements of a worldview, what we're saying here is that given these particular subjects, that each one of them, although there's some overlap among them, each one of them is in every worldview. That every worldview will have an axiology. Every worldview will have an anthropology. Every worldview will have an epistemology, etc. So we call them elemental. They're part of it. You cannot do without them. Some would argue that there are more than this. And then some would argue, well, this whole business of theology, if I'm an atheist, why would I have a worldview that would contain theology? Well, it depends on how you define theology. Because you can be an atheist, and by definition, you have just created a theology. So, these are pretty comprehensive, and I have yet to find a worldview that didn't have one of these. And people a lot smarter and better educated than me said the same thing. These are at least the minimal elements of a worldview. So let's look at what an epistemology is. The word epistemology, really, it comes from episteme, it comes from pistes also, in Greek, which means to know. It's actually in the Bible, it's the same word we use to know in the Bible. You can know that you have eternal life. That's part of this root here, it's a cognate. So epistemology is the set of beliefs about the nature and sources of what you can know. Of knowledge. It's a huge subject. And let's talk about some of the questions that are up on the board before you. Is knowledge merely a state of the brain? What do you think? Think of two different worldviews that are in conflict with each other. Which worldview would say yes? Knowledge is just a state of the brain. An atheist might. Certainly. What, a humanist? How about a naturalist? A naturalist is somebody who believes that nature is all there is and there's nothing beyond nature. Kind of like Carl Sagan. The universe is all there is, all there was, and all there will ever be. And so a person who has that worldview will necessarily say that, yeah, knowledge is merely a state of the brain. If you turn off the brain, you turn off the knowledge. But what would a Christian say? You have a mind. Does the mind perdure beyond death, the physical death?
And it's different from the brain.
Yes. Yes. So knowledge, when you confront God when you die, as a Christian, we believe that it's appointed to man once to die, and then comes what?
Judgment.
And so we're going to face Christ. We're going to face the Lord. And we are going to know something, right? Mm-hmm. So knowledge is not merely a state of the brain. If there is indeed a spiritual life, then there has to be a spiritual knowledge. Make sense? Two completely different worldviews that have a different answer to this question. That's why this stuff is so interesting, at least to geeks like me, because there are all sorts of interesting questions that arise when you ask questions about epistemology, that when you probe into them, you really get to see the differences between the worldviews and why it's so hard for us to understand how somebody else believes. But it also gives us an opening to look at what it is that they, where they differ from us, and points of contact where we can start to engage them. And in some cases, even very cognitive, intellectual things like this can be engaged emotionally. We haven't time to discuss that, but we may on the second iteration. Okay, so we have epistemology is a manifestation of a cosmic mind. Well, if you're an atheist, you're not going to believe that. But could you believe it if you're something else? Is there some other ism that would say, yeah, it's the cosmic mind? A universalist, a pantheist? What do they call the people who like the crystals? And
New Age.
New Age people, yeah. I mean, isn't the essence of the New Age movement from 30 years ago, I don't know if they still do New Age stuff now, although I had a secretary who said she was a New Age person. And Buddhism, cosmic mind? I don't know. I don't know if there is a cosmic mind in Buddhism. Does anybody know? Brahma? I don't know. I guess I don't want to get us too lost into that. Here is one that's really important. Is there knowledge beyond the senses? And it's connected to this first one. Can you know something beyond what you can perceive physically? Okay.
Wait. No, I was about to say, because you can't physically sense what has happened in the past, but in a way you can, because you read about it or you hear about it. But there's no way to know, like, possibly 500 years from now, there will be a thing. There's no way to possibly know that.
So, in one sense, what you're describing, and I hadn't even thought of it that way, is there knowledge from beyond the senses? Can we have access to the future? The answer is probably no. We don't know what the future holds. We don't abide in the future, we abide in the present. But is there knowledge from beyond the senses? Ted?
Yeah, I'm thinking, what about our abstract thought and our mathematical concepts and our scientific concepts and notions?
Imaginary.
To where you come to...
Yes.
To come to the conclusion that the universe adheres to certain electromagnetic, gravitational, and nuclear laws, you've come to this conclusion through some observations, but you've gone way beyond those observations and inferred other characteristics about nature, the universe, and matter that happen to be true. So you inferred or created or discovered knowledge, not from your senses, but through your cognitive powers, and through our brilliant mathematicians and scientists from ages past.
Thank you.
You read and understand and comprehend it.
So
it's not physical.
All right, so we have our physical knowledge because we're looking at things, we're experimenting with things, we're doing things to the world, we're engaging the world's phenomena. But let's take this for a second and ask this question. A person is in a traffic accident. They're put into what we know as a persistent vegetative state. They have no brain waves except those that keep the autonomic functions going, and even some of those aren't working, so they have a heart thing keeping the heart going and breathing thing keeping the breathing going, etc. So basically this person isn't thinking at all and isn't experiencing anything. There's no, anytime they do any kind of stimulus whatsoever to this person's body, nothing happens in the brain. So for our hypothetical purpose right now, this person has no senses. And let's push it back. Instead of being in a traffic accident, let's say they're born that way. So they have never had the opportunity to hear the gospel. Is it possible for God to talk to such a person, to communicate with a person who has never had any physical experiences? Yes, please.
Yes.
Through the Holy Spirit.
We believe that the Holy Spirit does communicate to us, and the Holy Spirit can communicate to us from beyond the senses. Is that true? Yes. Yes. Is that a very different worldview than the naturalist worldview? Yes, a hugely different one. And so is there any real surprise when such a person who believes in naturalism looks at us and goes back to the poster that said people who have imaginary friends are stupid? No surprise. It's actually rational for them to believe that. It is rational. It's not right, it's not correct, but it is rational. It's coherent, it makes sense. Mara.
If it wasn't one of those people that didn't know, what about our conscience? I mean, we have all we're given a conscience, and is that you can't see it? I mean, how do you, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, is the conscience a source of knowledge?
It is.
Well, it's not trustworthy.
But it's,
it may not be trustworthy, but is it a source of knowledge? But let's answer the question. Is the conscience a source of knowledge?
Yeah.
It's a knowledge of what?
Of morality.
Of right and wrong, of some kind of value.
Right.
So is that from beyond the senses?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is.
Yeah,
you're not getting sense data that makes the conscience.
Could love be another one? Even though it evokes.
Maybe so. But what would you know through love? You could know through conscience, you could make a decision about morality. I guess love would be how I'm going to interact with somebody. I know I love this person or don't love them.
Right.
I don't know if that really qualifies as the kind of knowledge we're looking for. But let's just leave it as it is. Maybe it is. Maybe love is a source of knowledge. So, can anything be known for certain? Is the question of the philosophers of the ages, right? What did the skeptics say? Skeptics say, I'm not sure about that. It's like the guy who wrote the poster with the atheists and the Christians, and he says, I don't know anything and neither do you. That's the skeptic. That's the skeptic who's trying to grasp something and at the same time being absurd about it because they can say for certain that they're not certain. Yes, please.
Yeah, in this physics, I'm certain that if you hit me with a 2x4, it's going to hurt.
Is there certainty?
Go do it.
Yeah. Is there any way we could argue against that? Yes, please.
There is one thing that we always know for certain.
And what that is?
Our individual experiences.
Good.
We can't always come up with some kind of a universal law because not everybody experiences everything equally. Like even something as simple in the realm of art, the way people see color, because some people will see it more or less vibrant. But we know absolutely that from our own experiences that we understand some things are resolute. And we can't say that nothing is because we have at least some things that are resolute in ourselves.
Thank you. So can we know, for example, for certain that we exist? Of course.
I think therefore I am.
Of course, yeah. Cogito ergo sum, as it goes. But that's not the entire phrase, by the way. But yeah, I think therefore I am. I mean, that's kind of sort of the basic of foundationalism. But are there things of which we think we could be certain and we really can't be? Think of science. Think of science. Go ahead. You're going that way.
In science, there's no certainty. Everything is, you can get more accurate and more accurate and more accurate. But there's no absolute in science. You keep testing. It's just the basic rule in science.
Yeah.
At least in our society.
Thank you.
Even the foundational laws of thermodynamics. My professor told me that we believe they're absolutely true because they've never been proven to be wrong. But there's no reason to believe they are absolutely true except that they've never failed.
It's known as the problem of induction. The problem of induction is that you cannot, we do not have access to the future. That we do not dwell in the future, we don't have immediate access to it. So it's possible, it's at least logically possible, that the things that we've seen that have happened with incredible regularity, matter of fact, we could even say absolute regularity, that every time we dropped something, it went down instead of falling up. Okay, the law of gravity. We call it a law because we think it's immutable and it's convenient. It's a linguistic convenience to describe it that way. But as Mark said, and as your professor said, it's at least logically possible that somewhere down the road, either the law will change or we'll understand physics in a way that makes it senseless to call it certain. Well, no, that still obeys the laws of physics, though. The helium balloon, and there's a lot to that. But so here we are in 2015 saying at once the most important things in our society, the scientific things, and we get in an airplane and we're pretty certain that thing's not going to fly down instead of fly up, unless they misload it or the pilot decides he doesn't want to fly. We have some certainties, but even if we push those to the absolute limit, they're not really certain. All scientists who know what the laws of physics really are recognize they're only statistics. They're just this giant stochastic prediction based on immense histories of past events. We've tested the law of gravity innumerable times, and it's never failed us. So we predict it'll happen in the future. But who says the future will always resemble the past in exactly the same way that it's resembled it so far? So there are some things we can know for certain, there are some things we cannot. They represent different worldviews. And when you're engaging somebody, listen for what they have to say about things like this. This is just epistemology. We haven't even gotten into the other things yet. Just the epistemology. What do people think counts as knowledge? I think it's one of the two top things that influence a worldview. The other one is axiology. And I'll tell you what that is. I'm not going to make you wait till the end because you won't get to the end today. Because 10 to the minus 43, we already established the odds aren't going to happen that we're going to finish all this today. Axiology is the study of values and what people value and put their, how much they think something's important. That's axiology. Mark, you're looking at me like that. A-X-I-O-L-O-G-Y. Axiology. So all things like value theory, morality, ethics, even political theory, even some economic theories have axiologies. They're the things that we look at and ask the question, is this more important than this? Should I even put any value on it at all? You know, is there a purpose to the universe? Well, why should I care? Okay, that actually is part of an axiology. Do I believe that this has any value at all? Does purpose even mean anything? Why should I care about it? Why? So that's why I say that axiology, because it involves so many things, is things that we value, ultimately goes back to that emotional feature. That emotionally evocative events trigger things that we value. It brings to our senses and to our minds and to our, if you want to put it, to our hearts, something that's so immediate and so gripping that we have to make a decision. I hate this. I love it. This is terrible. This is great. This is wonderful. This isn't wonderful. I'm hurt. I'm not hurt. Things that I value. Things that mean something to me. So axiology, the emotional evocative events, what counts as knowledge, these are three of the most important things that are part of the worldviews that we're encountering when we deal with people who look at us and think, when they see the lady praying, that she's what? She has imaginary friends and she's stupid. All right. We did not get through all of this. So I'm going to open this to questions for a little bit. And we just start. I'm trying to gauge what we can do next time. I'll worry about that next time. Let's start with questions today.
I just wanted to, that's more a statement than a question. I wanted to jump back to, is there knowledge from beyond the senses?
Please.
And the laws of logic, is a way that we can extrapolate from what we know to what we observe or can experience from what we can know. Not for certain, but philosophers and scientists both use this heavily.
Warren, let's go back to the critical thinking class you were in. I don't know who the professor was, but he probably told you something like, there's rationalism and there's empiricism. Do you remember the two? Okay, the rationalist believes what? That you can come to a knowledge of reality just through your mind. And the empiricist, on the other hand, thinks what? That you acquire knowledge, well, how?
Experiences.
Empirically. You actually put your hands on things and make observations. So, what I hear you saying is that logic is one form of rationalism, that it can be used to rationalize, and not rationalize in the sense of justifying, but rationalize in the sense of putting things in order and making sense of them. That you can rationalize or make rational something that, and give you knowledge because of that, that you couldn't do without it. Do I understand you properly there? Thank you. Anything else before we close? Because we are going to close now. Yes, please.
For one of the ologies of the things that we were looking at earlier, one of them stood out to me because I didn't know what it was at all, but I looked it up for teleology, but the definitions are so all over the place. So what would you say?
Teleology is the study of the meaning of the purpose of things and the end. Like, what is the end of the universe? Not the end in terms of its temporal terminus, you know, not the end in time, but what is its end? Why do we even have a universe? What's the purpose of the universe? Or what is the, as some philosophers or theologians say, what is the end of man? Why is he here? What is the purpose of humanity? That's what teleology is about.
And in Greek, tele also means, besides the end, it
can
be translated
goal. Good, yeah. What is goal? What is the goal?
Intention,
purpose. Yeah, it's all about the purpose or meaning of things. And you can stretch it out to go to ultimate significance and those kinds of things, which is when I mentioned earlier on that there's overlap among these. You'll see that there's an overlap between teleology and epistemology, teleology and axiology. Axiology in the sense that, well, why should I care? What's the value in caring about purpose or meaning? I'm going to be here 130 years, 120 years, 110 years, and I die. If I'm a naturalist, I think that's the end. There's no purpose. There is no purpose. All right. It is now, on purpose, time to close. So let me leave you with this. We've gone over four different worldviews. We've explored how those worldviews actually collide and are, I use the term antipodal, but opposing each other. They're on different ends of the spectrum, if you will. That there are features of worldviews that can be known, that there are elements of worldviews. And if we learn what those elements are, it becomes easier to see how we engage people with different worldviews. And lastly, that we need to appreciate that the emotionally evocative events are significant enough to affect cognition as well as decisions. And worldviews are about cognition, decisions, and emotions. And we'll get more into this on another session. Thank you very much.